From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today, the water ban is lifted in Northwest Ohio, but will Toledo's water crisis be a wake-up call?
This probably caught the public more as a surprise than I think the scientists or the water quality professionals.
Then Young Workers of America unite, or not. Millennials aren't joining unions.
As workers become more dispersed and as they work more precarious jobs, perhaps multiple jobs, it becomes harder, of course, to find the solidarity to join a union.
And we'll head up north to find out what's cooking in Chef Mario Batali's kitchen. Come for the local food scene, stay for the ambiance.
Michigan beach pace, which is, if you could imagine being the most relaxed you ever felt, and then you take a deep breath and just go,
Those stories and more. Primary day is tomorrow, but is it actually an election day if no one shows up? This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll take a look at who's taking advantage of a low-key election. Then chef and restaurateur Mario Batali joins us. It's fair to say he's slightly obsessed with Northern Michigan. And we'll also take a look at the future of unions this hour. Younger workers say they support them, but they're just not joining them. We'll ask why. But first, the city of Toledo has now lifted a drinking water ban. The ban went into effect early Saturday after tests showed high levels of toxin in the city's drinking water. The toxin came from an algae bloom near the city's water intake. Mayor D. Michael Collins says city officials will take the next 48 hours to assess how the emergency was handled.
What did you do right? Mm-hmm. What did you do wrong? Where were your strengths? Where were your weaknesses? What were your opportunities and what were your threats?
Gary Fonensteel is a research scientist at the University of Michigan's Water Center. Gary, you have more than 35 years of experience working on algae in the Great Lakes. You've published scientific papers on these algae blooms. So help us understand what actually happened that led to this ban over the weekend.
Well, generally, I think what happened here is they had a large bloom of the algae microcystis, which is really not uncommon for Western Lake Erie in the last 5 to 10 years. We had relatively large blooms in 2011, 2013, and now it looks like maybe this year. So that bloom happened. And the interesting thing about that bloom is that's a microcystis, which is a cyanobacteria blue-green algae, and those blooms tend to form and concentrate up at the surface of the water, okay? And then we had a problem, and they do produce toxin, the toxin microcystin, which is a hepatotoxin that affects liver functioning. So basically that happened, and like I said, that's not that surprising for Western Lake Erie, but what was very surprising for me, at least, in this thing is the fact that the toxins were found at the water intake after treatment, okay? Because typically what happens is the blooms are at the surface, and the water intake is down near the bottom. So in this case, there's 20 to 25 feet between that high algal toxin concentration area and the water intake. And usually that's enough that you don't get high toxin concentrations at the intake.
So, Gary, then what happened to make it so that these algae blooms somehow got into the drinking water?
I don't know. That's a good question, and that's one I'd certainly like to know because, like I said, maybe there was a different algae, maybe there was some wind event, because there's a lot of linking between the meteorology and the phosphorus and all these things for producing these type events. I mean, it's think of it like this is a biological event, but think about the physical events that we know about, tornadoes, hurricanes, and the like. A whole bunch of factors have to all come together, such like the perfect storm, to get those events, and the same thing with this thing. Everything's got to kind of line up right, and I'm not really sure how it lined up to get it down there into the intake. Like I said, that's a surprise. Now, having low levels of toxins, not a surprise, but having it trigger the threshold, this is the first time I've heard this happening in the Great Lakes.
So it seems like this is a bit of a wake-up call that this happened, and is it likely that it could happen again?
Oh, and, well, I mean, I think the state of Ohio, I mean, these blooms, like I said, have been around for a while. I think we know about them, and maybe this can push us a little farther forward into the treatment and mitigation of these blooms. You know, I'd like to point out that, you know, I've done work not only in Western Lake Erie, but also Saginaw Bay and Green Bay, two other, let's say, hot spots for algal blooms in the Great Lakes. And the trends that we're seeing in Western Nigeria, the trends of increasing harmful algal blooms, is not occurring in those two environments. So there is something unique or something's particularly related to Western Lake Erie. So it's not like a panic everywhere, but certainly water quality people should be aware of the issue. And I think in general they are. I mean, I think this probably caught the public more as a surprise than I think the scientists or the water quality professionals working in the Great Lakes. This issue has been around for a little while.
So, Gary, what comes next? We're saying this could possibly happen again, but what should, say, the government be doing? What should residents, you know, be doing who rely on this water?
Well, there's a lot in that question. I think first you got to separate the drinking water issue from the blooms. Okay, the drinking water issues are pretty easier to deal with. I mean, the treatment people probably, and again, I don't know for sure because I'm not there, they probably just added a lot more activated carbon because it can remove the microcystin, and I think they just will probably have a lot more on store to deal with this issue in the future. So I think they can do it. The other thing, like the city of Toledo can do, it could move its intake. I mean, its intake tends to be in that bloom hotspot area, and if they move north, like if you notice, the city of Monroe doesn't have a drinking water advisory, and they get their water from Western Lake Erie too. They're you know, located a few miles north of Toledo. So if they move closer north towards the Detroit River, they're going to get clear, better water, and so the chances happen again would decrease. So I think those are things they could do, and they're probably doing at least the activated carbon now. Now, when you talk about the blooms, it's a little bit more involved and it gets a little more complicated to decrease the blooms and eliminate the blooms, which I don't think you'll ever do, given Western Lake Erie and its nature.
Gary Fonenstiel is a research scientist at the University of Michigan's Water Center. Gary, thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure.
Tomorrow is Election Day. Primaries across the state. More than 6.5 million registered voters in Michigan, and yet some are predicting less than 1 million will actually head to the polls. And a low turnout election means small things. Sometimes even just one thing can have a really, really big impact on how a race turns out. And in a bunch of closely watched races, Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan is hoping that he is that one thing. Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and also my co-host of It's Just Politics. Hi, Rick.
Hello, Zoe.
So, Rick, Mike Duggan is not on the ballot tomorrow.
And yet he is.
Exactly. So explain.
Okay, well, so the new mayor of Detroit is trying to show that he's got some muscle, some political clout. And so he's jumping in with endorsements. Now, he doesn't have to do this, especially this early on, but he's getting in the game.
He is. So let's start with one of the bigger games. And by that, of course, I mean one of the bigger races. The primary in Michigan's 14th congressional district. That's the seat that's being vacated by Democrat Gary Peters, who's running for the open U.S. Senate seat. What is Duggan doing in this race?
Well, this is the Democratic primary we're talking about because this is probably the most Democratic congressional district in the state.
Right.
And so whoever wins that primary is likely to be the candidate to win in November. And Mike Duggan has gotten behind Rudy Hobbs, a state legislator. But Hobbs, despite, you know, some big endorsements, Senator Carl Levin, his brother, Congressman Sandy Levin, even Gary Peters, he's really been struggling to gain traction as he battles it out with former Congressman Hanson Clark, the only Detroiter in the race, and Southfield Mayor Brenda Lawrence.
But Rick, how much do endorsements like Mayor Duggan's actually matter?
Well, I mean, the value of endorsements all on their own is questionable, although politicians do still seek them out. However, endorsements can be valuable if they come with, well, for example, money, campaign donations, or the promise of some type of independent expenditures, or if they come with members, supporters, volunteers who will staff phone banks, knock on doors, work election day, get out the vote operations. And also, we should point out, though, that elected officials like Mike Duggan in this case, they put their cachet on the line when they endorse. Endorsing in a safe race really doesn't add a lot of value, but throwing in to help someone someone in an embattled race get an inch past the goal line, now that's team building. So what Duggan has done here is he's putting both his cachet and his organization on the line.
So why is he doing it? Why is he jumping in and wanting to play in these races?
Well, the short answer is that Duggan wants to be a power player. He wants to be a big city mayor with big city influence.
I guess that's not super surprising, considering he comes from a powerful political machine background, which is known to do these kind of things, right? Pick a candidate, put your weight behind him, and then try to benefit from that.
All right, Mike Duggan, like a lot of Michigan Democratic politicians from Southeast Michigan, grew up in the Ed McNamara machine, the powerful Wayne County executive. But, you know, looking at some of these other races, you know, the mayor of Detroit, whoever it is, needs stuff from Lansing, needs stuff from Washington. And so this is Mike Duggan building a network to make that easier. If his candidates end up winning, he can use that. And we should also point out, this primary is also a chance for Team Duggan to test out its GOTV operations in support of candidates who aren't Mike Duggan. So if we game this out, presuming there's something to those polls that show a tight race for governor, if Duggan can do for the Democratic ticket in November what Detroit mayors are supposed to do, which is to turn out voters in the city, and Mark Schauer actually wins, then Duggan shows up in Lansing again as a kingmaker and a power to be reckoned with. And if it turns out that his endorsement carries weight outside the city, you know, that's even more so, which is, you know, why we've seen Mike Duggan, you know, for example, throw out an endorsement in an outstate state Senate race. He's basically testing his clout.
Right. But certainly there's a risk. I mean, you throw out an endorsement. If your candidate doesn't win, though, that's going to be an issue.
Oh, right. Right. That this is an opportunity to excel. This is an opportunity to fail. If Duggan's chosen ones don't do well tomorrow, well, that shows that he's got some work to do, some organization building. And, you know, speaking of practicing for whenever, if Duggan's ambitions do actually extend statewide, say for governor one day, it's also building the infrastructure for a Michigan-wide campaign someday off into the future.
And a lot of favors that he is then owed by candidates that he endorsed previously.
Mm-hmm, true.
Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, also my co-host of It's Just Politics, and surely one to be busy tomorrow on primary day.
Stop calling me Shirley. Thank you, Zoe.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Mario Batali, you know the name, celebrity chef, restaurateur, his orange Crocs. But what you might not know is that he is slightly obsessed with northern Michigan, Leelanau Peninsula to be exact. Welcome, Mario Batali, to Stateside.
Happy to be here.
So you came across northern Michigan in a way that sort of a lot of folks did. You married a woman. You went on vacation back to a place that she knew. Take the story from there.
Well, I married Susie Kahn, a New Yorker, who went to University of Michigan and studied natural resources and forestry. We had been married already a couple of years, and she had already come out a couple of times without me because I was working. And then it occurred to us that we should come out here and try a spot. She discovered it because a lot of her friends from college in Ann Arbor had actually retired up here. So this felt a little retirement-y, which made me a little nervous. And then I came up here. For the first week, we rented a house. The next year, we came back and rented a house for 2 weeks. The next year, we came back and rented a house for 3 weeks. The fourth year, we came back, and we wanted to rent the house for the whole summer. And the guy said he was moving back in, so we had to find something else. So we shopped around for a little while and found a nice little house on the lake, and we've been coming here now for 14 years.
Right. You're right in Traverse City. And I want to get back to that nugget when your wife said, hey, let's go vacation in Michigan.
Right.
Were you like, what? Michigan?
I was like, well, you know, I don't know, a lake. It seemed small. It seemed a little weird. And it was okay. I'd never been here, so we got here, and first of all, I'm like, I didn't realize we were on an ocean. And second of all, the water is as blue as the Caribbean. The sand here is as soft as the most amazing places in Hawaii I've ever been. And yet there's a remarkable little statement on T-shirts all over the place that it is unsalted and shark-free.
You fell in love with northern Michigan, as I think most Michiganders do. What is it about northern Michigan for you?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. From the gastronomy point of view, which is always one of my first points, this is wine country.
So there is, by definition, a lot of people interested in food and wine. They make magnificent local wine, and with that comes magnificent local cheese. There's a delicious culture of cherries. There's a magnificent understanding of great small farmers that are making these delicious products that they either ferment or they just sell to you raw. But gastronomically, it's very easy to fall in love with the place because almost everything is delicious. And anybody that celebrates cherry pie in the way that Traverse City and the Leelanau County can, it's just something that is so special and so geospecific. I travel all over the world, and the things that make me the most excited are the ones that are celebrating the things that have been there because they grew out there.
Well, let's talk about that. We are in the middle of summertime in northern Michigan. What's getting you the most excited right now?
Well, right now it's strawberries. But in 2 weeks, we'll have real local cherries, which are tremendously exciting. And everything that goes around with them. I mean, you know, there's Lake Michigan whitefish. There's the whole culture of pickles that is happening from last year. We're still celebrating all of the pickles that happened at the end of the season, but everyone's getting ready to start doing their pickles. One of the things they do here is they take the tart cherries and they pickle them with coriander and salt and sugar and onions, and it's something that is so good with salami that it's mind-blowing that I never discovered it until this year.
Mario, you live in New York during the rest of the year. What is the pace about northern Michigan? I mean, obviously, it's completely different than New York City, but part of me has to ask, do you ever get bored?
Well, I must say, there are two separate paces. There is the New York pace, obviously, and then there's the Michigan pace. And then there's 2A, which is Michigan beach pace. You can imagine being the most relaxed you ever felt, and then you take a deep breath and just go, it's almost like everyone sighs up here. The pace is remarkable in that there's always something to do, but boredom would be my objective. I would say that if I could ever be bored in my life, I might be very, very happy, but there's always something I can do, and I always feel excited about it, whether it's a beach walk or a Petoskey Zone search or to play golf in some of the amazing golf courses I love up here.
So, you know, one of the things that I heard, I was recently up north talking to folks in Glen Arbor, which, oh, I don't know, is about 30 minutes away from Traverse City. Glen Arbor was recently named, I think, by Good Morning America or some morning show like that, you know, the most beautiful place in the United States. And one thing I heard from folks there who live there year round is, you know, we depend on tourists. We need their money for the economy. But sometimes it's just a little too much. And I noticed that you do a spectacular job of talking up Michigan. Are there any Michiganders who have come to you and were like, Mario, be quiet. like stop talking us up.
on more than one occasion, you'll get people that come over to me, give me a little wink and just say, shh. But at the end of the day, they know it. I mean, you know, there's a couple of intense moments up here. And when I say intense, like Cherry Festival. Mm-hmm. So it's the 4th of July weekend and the week after that. At that point, maybe you have to wait 5 or 6 minutes at a traffic light for two lights to pass through to get that. It's still not what I would consider even remotely close to the intensity of a major metropolitan area. And yet there's still a lot of vibrancy to it. Yeah, every now and then people say, why don't you just stop talking about this? I don't think that it's ever going to get like Long Island or Martha's Vineyard or anything like that. It'll never be. There's just too much of it here. There's so many places to go, and there's so many miles and miles and miles of pristine and magnificent beaches. I can't see that it will be overcrowded in my lifetime.
Mario, in the last couple of minutes that we have, let's get back to food. Give me an idea of what you might make for dinner this week.
Well, tomorrow I'm making a fabulous dinner.
Tell me.
Tomorrow we're going to start with pizzas, and we're going to use the local raclette from Leelanau Cheese Company. And we're going to use some pickles that I made last year, and we're going to use a little bit of the smoked whitefish that I sprinkle over the top of the pizza with some hot chilies. And I get the whitefish from Carlson's down in Leland. And then for the main course, we're doing some ribeyes of grass-fed beef from Michigan, grilled and served with a bunch of vegetables that I got at the farmer's market from a place called Bare Knuckle Farms. Susie, my wife, is making her world-famous upside-down rhubarb cake that everyone's going to relish in. And then we'll do the end of the strawberries with a little bit of whipped cream and the beginning of cherries just by themselves, and I put a little balsamic vinegar to dip into it.
Mario Batali, chef, restaurateur, northern Michigan lover. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Zoe.
Thank you. Normally, I wouldn't think anything of a tweet that reads, "What a beautiful fall day." But when that tweet comes in August, it's a little disconcerting. Yes, okay, it's been gorgeous, a little cool, sunny, breezy. But with temperatures over the past few weeks dipping into the 50s, it's hard not to think about the bigger consequences. The Union of Concerned Scientists recently said that if climate trends continue, Michigan agriculture will be harmed. And that's really a big issue when you consider that agriculture is the state's second largest industry. Philip Robertson is a professor in the Department of Crop and Soil Sciences at Michigan State University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Jim Byram, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Welcome.
Zoe, a pleasure to be with you.
Here's what we know just to set the scene. Obviously, the world's climate is changing. That is impacting weather patterns, which is, of course, impacting the way that we grow our food. What impacts are we already seeing here in Michigan? Philip Robertson, let's start with you.
Well, we've seen a number of climate changes over the past few decades. And if we think about climate change as having two different components or two different kinds of climate change, we can think about well-behaved climate change, which is change that is relatively predictable, and then what I would call ill-mannered climate change, which is the unpredictable episodic part of climate change. And the well-behaved change includes things like warmer average temperatures. We've seen about a 1.5 degree temperature change over the past 100 years or so. 1.5 degrees doesn't sound like a lot. You know, you're not going to change your sweater weather habits based on that. But it means, for Michigan farmers, longer growing seasons, which primarily means earlier springs. We've seen about 15 days of more frost-free time in Michigan summers. Means more temperate plant hardiness zones. That is, the plant hardiness zones are more like Indiana used to be. And then we have the ill-mannered change, and that is the kind of change that keeps me up at night. And this is an increase in the frequency of extreme events like heat waves and droughts. We're seeing an increase in the number of heavy rainfalls over the past few decades. That also means, with no change in total rainfall, longer dry periods. And we've also seen more heat waves, more days greater than 95 degrees in the summertime, but also wintertime heat waves have been more frequent. We've seen a lot more winter thawing in the past few years, and there's a couple of good examples of how that has affected Michigan agriculture, particularly the fruit crops.
Sure, we saw the cherry crop in 2012, 90% being devastated. So, Jim, help us understand, what does all of this, as Philip just explained, what does that mean for the food that's being grown right now in Michigan?
Well, I think Phil gave a good overview of what climate change implications are for the state and what kind of things we see. I think it's also important to realize that being surrounded by water in the Great Lakes either increases our susceptibility to the good things or the bad things on both ends of the extreme. For example, Lake Michigan, I understand, just flipped over here a couple days ago, and we now have water temperatures on the western or on the eastern shore, which would be the western shore of the Lake Michigan for the state of Michigan, that are in the 40s.
40 degrees.
So we have all sorts of things that impact production agriculture. The positives are that we're seeing what I refer to as production further north. There's corn and soybeans being grow there further north in the state of Michigan. However, there's other downsides that we have to recognize, and Phil got into a little bit on the ill-mannered effects of climate change, and I think it's important to recognize that those bad effects, if you will, those challenges, are the extremes. This past winter caused us in Michigan to plant crops later than normal because spring didn't warm up as we would have expected it to. Phil indicated we've had, and we agree, normally about a 15-day longer growing season. The irony is this year, we're going to have probably about a 30-day shorter growing season. What we're seeing is variability. We're seeing variability, we're seeing severity, we're seeing increased frequency of severe storms, and that's causing farmers to try to create some resilience to some of these effects. The challenge is for some of the specialty crops, especially as you see variability in weather, that causes some challenge for them because they operate basically in what we call almost a mini environment, like the cherry crop in northwestern Michigan or southwestern Michigan, the dry bean crop in the Thumb and Saginaw Valley, even the sugar beet crop in the Thumb and Saginaw Valley. They have to be planted early, perhaps the end of March into April. This year they didn't get planted till May. So as we look at specialty crop challenges, those may be more intense than for some of the traditional commodity crops that we're more familiar with.
So help me understand then for farmers who are dealing with this. I mean, right now, are they being reactive, realizing that the weather patterns are changing and changing either how they're growing or when they're growing? Or are some farmers actually starting to sort of be proactive and looking at different crops and buying land further north?
Well, that's absolutely the case we're seeing. We're seeing production move north. We're seeing some farmers in the traditional production areas buy land up north. We're actually seeing some agribusinesses, some of those that supply fertilizer and crop protection materials to farmers, actually create more facilities in the north or even handle grain in the north. And that's a direct reflection of the impact of climate change. So farmers, as I mentioned, more irrigation, more drainage. In terms of changing cropping systems, there's actually some of that that happens because I use the dry bean industry as an example. Michigan used to grow about 90% of the navy beans grown in the United States. Then over the past 20 years, a lot of that industry moved to a North Dakota, Minnesota, the Red River Valley. And even today, that industry is moving into Manitoba and Saskatchewan, which is purely a reflection of the changing climates in both of those areas, which does directly impact cropping systems.
We seem to all hear about climate change, be very worried about it, reading headlines about Michigan's crops. I mean, but you're both making it sound like, okay, you know, climate is changing, we're adapting, we're going to be okay. Is that true?
Zoe, that's a great point, because we're seeing in our industry and production agriculture more disease pressure, some additional insect pressure and weed pressure. Sure, there's short term some what could be viewed as positives, like, hey, longer growing season, I can produce more, yields go up. Yeah, I can manage some of the issues of rain and drought. The challenge is we're seeing an increased pressure of what we call invasives or non-traditional pests. In one crop that's pretty near and dear to us, 20 years ago or 15 years ago, we never sprayed a fungicide, never really had a disease problem. Today, it's a huge issue. Now, we're seeing that across the board in some fruit and vegetable crops as well. We're seeing weeds that are coming into Michigan we haven't seen before, and insects. I mean, the bug populations, you've seen some of those B-52 mosquitoes this year. You can just appreciate that we're seeing some things blowing in here on the wind from the south that are living that didn't used to.
So how badly will Michigan be impacted compared with, let's say, more southern states?
Well, as the climate changes, as Jim mentioned, we're going to be seeing production push into more northerly areas. And so given that we're in the northern part of the Corn Belt presently, many of our field crops will not be immediately adversely impacted because those crops are already growing well in warmer climates. One thing that will affect Michigan in the larger sense is that we have a very diverse agriculture in Michigan, the second most diverse in the country after California. And as a result, the climate changes that we see are going to affect different parts of agriculture differently. While the field crop growers, the corn and soybean growers, for example, to some extent the sugar beet growers, will be able to adapt in the short term, that may not be as easy for the fruit and vegetable growers who face special challenges with respect to wintertime heat waves, for example. And so specific industries may be, specific parts of the agricultural industry may be much more affected than others, and that localized effect could be quite extreme.
Well, yeah, I think it's important to note that climate change is also causing dramatic impacts on markets.
Mm-hmm.
For example, 2012 crop production, the Midwest had a huge drought. That caused prices to go up, corn and soybeans, et cetera, food prices. This year, it's projected we're going to have a terrific crop, which is causing prices to go down, at least commodity prices, not necessarily food prices. But the swing, if you will, that's actually brought about because of the extremes and the severity of extremes is a risk mitigation issue that farmers are going to have to really pay close attention to.
Well, finally, in the last minute or two that we have here, let's look ahead. I don't want any of us to sound too hyperbolic, but I do want to look maybe 50, 100 years. And are we talking about that one day we could actually be growing things like cotton in Michigan?
The one thing that impacts production systems is, of course, infrastructure. And I don't think we have cotton gins that will be in Michigan anytime soon.
Okay.
But what we are seeing are severely taxed transportation infrastructure systems. For example, we'll grow corn here and soybeans here for a long time, but are we going to grow corn and soybeans in the Upper Peninsula? There is absolutely no infrastructure up there to handle that. Will there be in the future? I'd suggest yes.
Yeah, so we do have a lot of adaptation tools in the toolbox, and these include, as Jim mentioned, a few of the different crop varieties and different crops, irrigation, at least until groundwater depletes, more intensive pest management, frost protection systems, and animal cooling systems can all contribute to adaptation over the short term. Over the long term, looking 50, 60, 80 years out, we can probably expect to see some new varieties, new crops being grown in Michigan that perhaps aren't being grown today to the same extent. Over the lifetime of the farmers who are currently farming, adaptation will probably be the rule. And most of those adaptations, while they won't be painless and they'll certainly affect operating costs, they will probably be achievable. Over the longer term, next generation out, we may be seeing a very different farming, perhaps more akin to the farming that is currently occurring farther south in Kentucky, perhaps even Arkansas in 100 years, absent any efforts to rein in the factors that are causing climate change.
Philip Robertson is professor in the Department of Crop and Social Sciences at Michigan State University, and Jim Byram is president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Quite welcome, Zoe. Thanks.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. A senior American health official says the U.S. is sending at least 50 public health experts to West Africa over the next month to tackle the worst ever outbreak of Ebola. Thomas Friedman, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, told the BBC that Ebola was currently out of control, but could be easily stopped with basic health practices.
What we're doing now at CDC is surging our response. We are going to put at least 50 public health experts in the three countries in the next 30 days. Because actually, we do know how to stop Ebola. It's old-fashioned, plain and simple public health. Find the patients, make sure they get treated, find their contacts, track them, educate people, do infection control in hospitals. You do those things, but you have to do them really well, and Ebola goes away.
Even with that, though, the question remains on the minds of many. What is the possibility of Ebola spreading? Eden Wells is an epidemiologist at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So one of the big concerns that we're hearing about is air travel, that the U.S. Right. is just one flight away from the virus. How troubled should we be by that?
A lot of people, understandably, hearing about a case of Ebola, a fearsome disease, can travel from one country to another. But I think we in public health have known that diseases like this of all kinds travel without any regard for boundaries, especially with the way we all fly around the world. Everything's so global now. But when a patient arrives in another country like Nigeria, becomes sick on a plane, and then a few days later passes away in a hospital, that frightens people, and especially to think that maybe one plane flight from an affected area such as Western Africa, the three countries that have been impacted with this great epidemic, that one flight could increase the chance of one person maybe on that flight arriving in the United States who is ill.
Well, so let's talk about the likelihood of that happening.
You know, I think that it's a lot less of a likelihood now than it was a few days ago. And the reason why is that in the West African countries, such as Liberia, they had not been executing some of the practices we do in our airports. Mm. We don't allow sick people to get on planes. And we also would screen anybody coming off of a plane or even during a flight should they become ill. And there's also a public health system here that is a bit more developed than what we're seeing in West Africa that has suffered a lot of issues, you know, civil strife, difficult, arduous type of public health systems, that it's been hard for them to actually control disease spread. Most of the time, we're able to keep people who are sick off planes. Mm-hmm. We have a system here in the United States that the Centers for Disease Control would be immediately aware if somebody was on a plane that became ill. Yeah. Especially from now that we from a country that we know is having Ebola. And there are procedures in place to quickly isolate that patient, identify those that patient's been in contact with, and immediately stem and control any potential spread.
And that's what I want to get to. I mean, how capable is the U.S. public health infrastructure? Are we set up for that?
Well, you know, I was just thinking on Friday that when the Centers for Disease Control has started to go to West Africa, mm-hmm. pick up two American mm-hmm. patients who I think they're picking up one at a time mm-hmm. to bring back here to the United States. And I know that that caused a lot of fear when many of us, even in my family, my friends were saying, well, wait a minute, you're bringing Ebola to the United States and you know you're doing it. But we wouldn't do that without some knowledge that we are able to contain this type of disease. We have the public health infrastructure, but we also have the healthcare knowledge and ability. And those are two different things. Mm-hmm. The public health part, where we're actually screening at airports, having our health departments really look and be aware of disease, mm-hmm. but also our healthcare workers who know what to do if they have a suspect patient, how to control the spread.
Compared to other dangerous viruses, diseases, how quickly is Ebola spreading?
You know, interestingly, that's a very good question. There are other diseases out there. Measles comes to mind, are actually much more highly infectious than Ebola. Ebola requires a direct contact with fluids from the affected person. So it may be blood, it may be horrible things like vomit or diarrhea when they become ill. Certainly blood is always a concern. And that it requires a direct contact. You can't usually get it unless you're in close contact with the patient. Somebody actually has to have symptoms of the disease before they actually can spread it with Ebola. So there's some helpfulness there so that if you were traveling on a plane and somebody got off the plane, then became sick a little later, chances are you were not exposed to that person on the plane if they were not having fever, vomiting, diarrhea, bleeding. Okay, so that's a good marker. Most people also, when they become sick with something as fearsome as Ebola, get sick very quickly. And those are not people likely to get on a plane. They're not likely even people to go visit their neighbors because they don't feel well and they immediately become quite ill.
Finally, what will you be keeping an eye on in the mm-hmm. days to come, in the weeks to come, as we hear, unfortunately, most likely that the disease continues to spread?
I think there's going to be, I call this enhanced situational awareness. And doesn't that sound fancy? But in public health, there's many of us who will be keeping a very close eye on the case reports that come out daily from World Health Organization. World Health Organization is really, because this is a multi-country disease, is really our lead organization for public health. Our Centers for Disease Control is actually very active in working with World Health because of the expertise. So they're already, as of Friday, we're sending at least 50 or more experts from CDC there. And, you know, I think that we're going to be watching counts and we're going to be very attuned to listening to our clinicians, our health caregivers in our communities, if they have suspect cases, you know, and then, you know, giving them the information they need. If they have a suspect case of somebody who may have traveled in affected areas, how to isolate the patient, get the appropriate blood tests so that it can be quickly diagnosed, get them into the appropriate healthcare system, and then investigate and make sure no one's contacted. Can a case come that's undiscovered to the United States? Sure. I think it's slow. As I mentioned before, Liberia just late last week started even putting in some of those safeguards of screening people before they got on planes. The risk is low for many areas, but it's not zero. So all of us will be watching, monitoring, and listening closely to our state, our federal, and our international health departments.
Eden Wells is an epidemiologist at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
In the 1970s, at the height of its power, the UAW had more than 1.5 million members. Today, fewer than 400,000. Some of what's behind that is an aging union workforce. But it's not just the UAW. As many in the labor movement turn to retirement, unions are looking to rebuild and reinvent with younger members. Roland Zullo is with the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Roland, we know that younger workers, millennials, are more pro-union, and yet they're not joining those unions. What's behind this?
Well, there's some factors that are explaining why more younger people are attracted to unions. But the reason why more are not joining is that because we happen to have a very difficult environment out there to join. So forming a union takes a great deal of effort and risk on the part of workers. And there are many employees, many younger people who just simply don't take those risks.
Though when you look at the 1970s, there were these risks being taken, maybe less so in the 80s and 90s and the aughts. So what has happened then fundamentally to change younger workers being ready to do that?
Job insecurity is the main one. So the fact that there's been a great loss of employment nationwide, but especially here in the Midwest, where we've lost in the past decade, we've lost roughly half of our manufacturing employment. So it's very difficult in that context to take the risk of joining a union and angering the boss who uses the threat of job dislocation, threat of moving, shutting down the factory, moving somewhere else as a way to discourage unionization. And that's one of the most imposing threats that workers face today.
How much does it also have to do with just how jobs are changing? That as we're seeing less manufacturing jobs, if you're talking about, and younger workers tend to maybe be freelancers or work a few different jobs at once, how much of that is playing into this?
And that's another dimension as well. As workers become more dispersed in different locations, and as they work more precarious jobs, perhaps multiple jobs in different places, it becomes harder, of course, to find that community of interest strong enough to find the solidarity to join a union. That's also at work as well.
I wonder also, too, is there something about social media and technology that people don't necessarily feel the need to be represented by a physical group of people because somehow they get a certain level of support from an online group?
Social media is a factor, but I would say social media is a bigger factor in garnering support. What's more available now than ever before, because it's outside of the mainstream media, are much more positive stories about what unions are doing in the communities to help elevate the conditions for all workers. Unions have always done this, but now we see this as a growing strategy among labor unions. The Fight for 15 campaign to try to get $15 an hour wages at fast food franchises is being underwritten by a labor union. The Walmart campaigns to try to improve conditions for Walmart workers is being, again, underwritten by a labor union. So the more young people see that and know that, they realize that the labor movement has never been about simply organizing members under one roof. They've always been more broadly about the working class population.
Did labor unions miss the ball in the 80s and the 90s trying to get younger workers? Did they just sort of not look at that generation, but now are sort of paying for it decades later?
I think they've always been interested in younger workers. What happened, I think, in the 1980s is they were very slow to see how their own membership was being decimated by capital flight. The 1980s really marks the period, the early 1980s, the recession, especially from 80 to 82, marked the period in which you saw waves of plant closings and huge membership losses among the major labor unions out there. In that early period, labor was gambling or waiting for that economic era to adjust itself, and it never did. So membership continued to decline after that point.
Let's go back to this idea then, you know, okay, so younger workers maybe did start feeling some of the pain of the economy. We saw groups like Occupy Wall Street. Did labor do enough to see that anger and harness it?
Well, Occupy Wall Street was a very important event in that it symbolized the amount of anger out there. The Occupy Wall Street movement was primarily led not so much by people in the working class, but by middle class younger folks who weren't seeing the opportunity that they had been promised. And what happened soon after Occupy Wall Street began, and of course we had Occupies in many different places in the country,
sure,
labor unions did support those efforts by providing direct monetary support, offering their union halls up. And it did again, it was important because all of the origins of Occupy Wall Street were outside of the labor movement. It looked so much like the kinds of activism that you saw in the 1930s that predated the rise of labor unions. So the question is whether or not labor unions can capitalize on the discontent out there and help working people, better their conditions.
So if we see in the next decade, two decades, the majority of folks who were part of unions in the 70s and 80s retiring, getting out of the workforce, if we continue to see membership where it is right now, what do unions look like in 2030, 2040?
That's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for you. I can say this, though. I want to just comment about the retiree aspect of
Please.
It. Many unions, including the UAW, have actually very active retiree chapters. Just because someone leaves the employment situation and exits as a formal union member doesn't mean they get completely cut off from the union movement. There are retiree chapters all over the country that try to keep their former members active, especially in political affairs. So it's actually important that these older retirees stay connected because they're the ones who can teach the younger generation coming forward many of the lessons that are important to run and to be active in the union movement.
Roland Zullo is with the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for coming in.
Very welcome.
So we recently asked people on our Facebook page for their ideas about hidden gems in Michigan. One of the answers was the Cascade Falls in Jackson. The landmark was created in the 1930s by a local businessman. But these days, the Cascades need some help. The County Parks Department is trying to raise almost $10 million for renovations to the mechanical plumbing and electronic parts of the falls. Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris and Lucy Perkins decided to visit the Cascades.
It's this huge man-made waterfall. It's terraced. There's like the top and it kind of rolls its way down to the bottom.
And the best part is it lights up. It's nighttime, so it's dark out. And it's lighting up in these like, it's a Kool-Aid red. And then it'll go to like a hot purple with a blue. And so it's these really cool colors that are lighting up and they're changing with the beats of the music.
The control room used to look like NASA when you come in here. There was big blue boxes and knobs and switches and tape recorders and dials. And now it's just all condensed down into just a desktop computer now that runs everything. My name is Josh Hunt, and I'm the Parks Maintenance Technician here at the Jackson County Parks. It takes an hour to program 15 seconds of a song. So if we picked a three-minute song, you can do the math. It's going to take quite a while for us to set in here and actually program the lights to dance to that song. There's 51 channels in the falls that could be any different color at any different time, and you have to manually go through and pick for every beat of a song what you want those 51 channels to be. Our computer holds about 18,000 songs on it right now. Oh, we have Hungry Like the Wolf by Duran Duran, and then we have In the Mood playing. And then Should I Stay or Should I Go? And then John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John from Grease playing a little bit. So we try to cover everything. A little No Doubts in there.
And there it goes. I think I found my thing.
All right, so can I ask you about the Cascades now? So first of all, I'd love if you could introduce yourself. Who are you?
Christy West. I'm the manager at Cascades Falls. The economy has been tough as far as people, jobs in the last maybe 5 to 10 years, but I think we're on the upswing. You have a lot more people, getting jobs, and it's a very family-friendly area. So we cater right to that. We're maybe a break away from if people have lost jobs or things are rough on them. I think we're sort of a nice little break from that, too.
The Cascades are open every night this summer from 8 until 11 o'clock. That piece was produced by Lucy Perkins and Kyle Norris. And that's today's show. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, and Kayla Steinberg. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.